Hello and welcome to the Angels Costumes Behind the Seams podcast. I'm Jeremy Angel.
I'm Jonathan Lippman.
I'm Richard Green. And today we're going to be listening to an interview that I did with Giles Gale. I want you to speak to Giles because he, as I say in the interview, wears two hats. He is both a costume designer in and of his own right, but he's also a costume supervisor, and he has just finished working on the last series of The Crown, which is a massive production, of course.
He's the first person that we've had in our conversations that does straddle both worlds.
Yes, very successfully.
Did you deal with him on Father Brown as well as on The Crown, Richard?
No, I think you did, Jonathan, didn't you, Father Brown?
Yes, yeah. The designing side of what he does tends to be handled by me, and then because he's supervised for Michelle Clapton and then done dailies for other designers that have already had deals set up. So Giles did 5 episodes of Land Girls. And it was actually the Land Girls that introduced him to the producer of WPC 56 and then Father Brown.
What I really would like to do at one point is just take one person's career and sort of, you know, it was almost like a game of consequences. Just sort of, you know, they met so-and-so because they met so-and-so.
It's connections and relationships that get formed.
It is absolutely that, isn't it? Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's as good as... That's as good as any reason for getting a job, because so much of what we do is about collaboration and communication.
And trust and track record, I suppose. You know, safe pairs of hands and all those things.
With The Crown obviously now gone for quite a few series, and it's had several different designers. Have you noticed much change in the way the designers and the supervisors work between the seasons?
I think diplomatically I'd have to say no.
I mean, sorry, let me rephrase the question.
I will answer the question, but I think the answer is that it's probably slightly easier now, just because there is more reference and there's more color footage, of course. I mean, don't forget what they're doing on The Crown is they're matching quite a lot of, and we talk about this in the interview, the big set pieces which they have in every series. Quite often they're intercutting with footage, with newsreel and actual recreation. So for argument's sake, the investiture of Prince of Wales, Amy had to copy the outfit that the Queen was wearing at that time, including an extraordinarily peculiar hat, if I remember rightly. Mm-hmm. So you know, it was a recreation. So obviously she was very much constrained by that. Whereas in the early days, I think because there was perhaps less footage, Michelle maybe had slightly more freedom to interpret the Queen's costumes and things as it went along.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think with both Michelle and Jane,
because
the middle season was Jane Petre, and the approach that they had was, you know, obviously the logistics of the production and the shoot schedule are massive. So they have to choose their style concept, you know, from the start and take that course all the way through.
We've spoken to Ray, who did Doctor Who. There's now, we've spoken to Giles on The Crown and hopefully Amy to come. And we might speak to some other people from other large TV series. Do you think there's a massive challenge for designers and supervisors when they take a show that's already been established by another designer, say for season one or season two? Or what do you think the challenges that it throws up from the outside point of view, or dealing with those designers on the next season with different designers?
I think it's a very interesting question, because in the case of the Doctors, of course, quite often the designer changes when the Doctor changes. So, I mean, I'm going to be talking to Howard Burden, who, again, of course, I'm looking forward to talking about Red Dwarf and all of that connection.
I can't wait for that.
He was the Peter Capaldi Doctor Who designer. So, you know, I can certainly talk to him about that. So in a way, they kind of get a clean slate when you get a new Doctor, get a new frock.
Mm.
Whereas things like The Crown, I suppose, well, again, different periods, you know, because it's moving on, different fashion. So perhaps they're using the same skills and the same tools. They're just actually in a different fashion plate.
with Peaky Blinders, Alison wanted to make it a lot darker than it had been before, and she took it in her own different way. It is interesting. I always find it interesting watching TV series which have different designers to see if you can notice a change. And it's not always a bad thing if you can notice a change, because it's new season, new stories, I suppose.
Well, yes, I would think that's absolutely the case. And of course, you know, designers tend to be quite paternal about their productions. I mean, Game of Thrones is an interesting example where I can't imagine that anybody but Michelle and Alex, you know, whether they would have wanted anybody else to work on that.
The Crown has quite a few, or has had quite a few, large military scenes. Does that throw any massive problems for you in the military department with the large numbers they need?
Yes. You know, there were a couple of set pieces that we did for this series, which I don't think is a spoiler. We mentioned one of them in the interview, which is the Knights of the Garter procession at Windsor. But also there was a Trooping the Colour. In fact, there were two Trooping the Colours. And of course, what people may or may not know is the fact that there are five regiments of guards, and the Queen wears or wore a different uniform depending on which particular regiment was receiving the colours. It's Trooping the Colour, so she's awarding a colour to one of the battalions of the guards. So she wears a different uniform.
Oh, wow.
First of all, her uniform is like nobody else's. The original is in the Guards Museum at Wellington Barracks. So we went down and had a look at that. But she wore a very particular hat that we had to recreate, and her uniform tunic is a particular style. And of course, she rode side saddle. So she wore a skirt rather than breeches and boots. So that was an interesting one. And of course, you know, if you see Trooping of Colour in live or on TV, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of uniforms there. And of course, we hadn't got that number, but we've got 75 odd guards uniforms, you know, which is a good start. And again, by clever matching in, I assume that they're going to make it fairly kind of seamless.
You also had at the start, wasn't it Churchill's funeral?
Yes, we've had Churchill's funeral. We've had the coronation. We've had her wedding. We've had various trips abroad, where, of course, you know, again, Prince Philip wears different uniforms. Famously, if you remember, you know, those white uniforms that they wore on the trips to places like Kenya and Australia and things. So yes, it's nice. I mean, from a uniform point of view, it's nice to have a challenge like that. Very nice.
We hope you've been enjoying these interviews, and we've been loving getting your feedback. If you'd like to speak to us or send us any questions, please email us at podcast@angels.co.uk. You can also follow us on social media. We're on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We're just Costume Podcast on all those platforms, or you can visit our website, which is www.angelsbehindtheseams.com. And now here's Richard's interview with Giles.
Hi, my name's Richard Green from Angels Costumes, and today I'm talking to Giles Gale. Giles occupies an interesting position because he has two hats. He is both a costume designer and a costume supervisor. Giles, hello, how are you?
Hello, Richard. I'm good, thanks.
Good, good. So tell me, how did you start in the business?
Well, I started at the BBC, but I left school when I was 16. I didn't study costume.
Right.
I didn't really know what I wanted to do. Kind of left at time, like mid-80s, when there was quite high unemployment. And
of course,
I didn't really get very much. Yeah, there was not much career advice from my school. It was kind of the best you could hope for was a job in a bank.
Right. So the world of banking's loss is the world of costumes gain then?
Well, kind of, yeah. I'm not sure quite how I would have done doing that. But I came to London and I ended up working in a restaurant called L'Escargot.
Oh, yeah, I know L'Escargot. Very, very smart. Yeah. Very nice.
Yeah. So I was working as a cashier, and all the waiters, they all had these other jobs where they were actors or singers or artists, designers. And I kind of thought, well, I'm just like these guys. Perhaps I could do something interesting as well, but I didn't really know what.
Right.
I didn't really feel I had any particular skills. So I thought I would join the BBC. So I got a temp job in the BBC and moved around a few different departments and ended up working in costume.
Right. On the third floor at White City, presumably.
On the third floor, yeah. And I kind of... Yeah. Yeah. I absolutely loved it, and I really felt that I fitted in there.
You found a sort of bunch of creative people, and you and recognised that these were the sort of people that you associated with.
Yeah, I mean, there was wonderful people there, you know, at all levels, And I just I first thought, well, this is something that I could do.
So who did you work with at the BBC? I mean, they tended to move you around, didn't they?
Yeah, all sorts of different shows, all sorts of people. Les Lansdowne I worked with a lot, Ros Ebert, Annie Hardinge.
So what were you then? You were a dresser?
Yeah, so I started off in the office, processing all the timesheets for the designers. And then I was given a job as a dresser on a three-month contract and then made staff. And, you know, it was great. You just went around different locations.
Dressers basically, for anybody who's listening who doesn't know, the dressers were what the BBC staff that went out to actually wrangle the costumes and get the actors.
Yeah, it was a lot more personal then. I think you would have to physically dress people, obviously, particularly in period clothes, which you still do now. And so I think even that kind of was quite a learning experience, you know, just feeling comfortable being sort of up close and personal with people. It, you know, comes in really useful later on in your career.
And I mentioned the fact that you wear two hats. You're both a costume designer in your own right and a wardrobe supervisor, and your costume supervisor indeed on this current series of The Crown. But when did you get your first design job?
I was working with Amy Roberts, who I've worked with a lot over the years, who's been a real kind of mentor for me. And we'd done a series called William and Mary with Martin Clunes and Judy Graham.
Right.
Amy didn't really want to do the second series. And the producer said to her, do you think Giles could do it? And I never really thought that I could.
But you did.
I did. And, you know, I wanted the challenge. And I really enjoyed it.
And you rose to the challenge.
Yeah, it was great. And then I kind of did a few more designing jobs. And then I was really lucky. I started working for BBC Birmingham and I did a series called Father Brown, which I think is on its like sixth or seventh series now.
Yeah, I think so.
And that's when I really got to know Angels well, because the whole show was out of Angels. And then I'd do another one for BBC Birmingham in the winter. And basically I spent 3 years working practically like staff for Angels, doing these different 40s and 50s shows.
Yes, I think we nearly signed you up to our pension scheme by mistake at one point, because we thought you were one of
them. I think if I arrived a little bit late, the receptionist would give me dirty looks.
You got a late form. Had to come and explain to Tim why you were late.
Exactly, it felt like that sometimes. But I mean, it was just so great for me because, you know, Angels is such a huge, daunting place. I mean, I can remember when I first started working there, when Amy was doing shows from there. And although you weren't supposed to, I'd sometimes, if she was fitting one of the leading actors, I'd bring them a cup of tea in the fitting room. Don't tell Daniel.
Yes. I
remember when I first started, it was so big and I used to not be able to find the fitting room. And I'd be wandering around the floor with this cup of tea.
getting cold
and by the time I found the room, it was empty. But you know, after doing these shows from Angels for 3 years, I just got to know the place so well. I would pride myself on being able to know as well or better than the costumiers where to find things and all those kind of hidden corners. I think it's all been moved around now.
Which, of course, is one reason why we keep moving the stock around so nobody can get too complacent about it. Hang on, Medieval was there last week. Yeah, well, we moved
it. Yeah, I know. I'm quite upset now when I return and things aren't where they used to be. Well, I left them.
So basically, from the BBC, you were learning your craft. You were working alongside some extremely talented people. And I've said this is a theme that I keep banging on about, the fact that people need to learn and put their time in and get the experience and get the confidence, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, I mean, I just really feel that I'm learning all the time. And
still.
Yeah, absolutely. In the last couple of years, I've supervised for some absolutely amazing designers, and I've learned new ways of working that it's just, it keeps it exciting.
Yeah.
It's been absolutely fantastic to think that in my mid-50s, I can work with these people and just find new ways of doing things.
Yeah, and again, you know, there are occasions when all of us think, oh, God, I've got to go in again, or I've got to do this, or I'm fed up with this. But in fact, it is a fantastic business and industry to work in, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So let's talk a little bit, if we can, about Amy Roberts and you and The Crown, because those three things have converged quite nicely at the moment. In fact, you're just about at the end of this series, aren't you? I think.
Hopefully we're going to give you all your costumes back in the next few weeks.
Yes, excellent. Good. And hopefully they'll all be there. But it's a massive series. It's extraordinarily popular and successful, and you are the costume supervisor for the whole thing, so everything basically rests on your shoulders in terms of logistics and stuff.
Yes.
Amy is an extremely talented designer, recreating costumes for specific pieces.
Yeah.
But you're the man that gets it all working and flowing.
Yeah.
So tell me what's the biggest set piece? Because the Crown is noted for its sort of key set pieces throughout each series, aren't they? So what do you say is the biggest or most challenging one this time?
Well, we did Order the Garter Ceremony,
right,
which came out of the blue about halfway through.
So halfway through, somebody said, "Yeah, we think we'd like to recreate that big ceremonial scene at Windsor, where the Queen and the Great and the Good all process in these blue velvet elaborate robes that don't exist."
And I had been warned that this kind of thing happened on The Crown, that suddenly, you know, you'll get a script amendment and there'd be like a fancy dress party that wasn't there before. Yeah, that was a really exciting one to do, because we kind of like put that together, well, with Angels a lot.
Well, yeah, you and I sort of pulled that one off quite nicely, I think, in the sense that we had some already, but we made some more for the principals, didn't we? And you know, again, Her Majesty has a separate badge to everybody else.
Yeah, so. I learned a lot about blue velvet robes.
Yes,
and the scene went really well. It was a slightly scaled down version, but it was great to see that through from just kind of reading it and researching it through, you know, being around on the shooting day. And yeah, it looked excellent.
And do you get a lot of reaction from the crew when you know, one of those things comes together and it works? Do people actually genuinely appreciate the work that you do, or do they just go, oh yeah, costume department's done that again, well done then?
I think it varies.
Mm.
I think that one we did because the whole scene felt sort of very, very formal, and there was this amazing choral music playing and a choir.
Right.
And it was actually a very moving scene. A lot of the times you don't really get the appreciation of what you do, because it's you know, you're talking about 300 crowd, and although the crowd are all dressed in 1980s or 1990s costumes that are kind of appropriate to where they are and what season it is, to a lot of the crew it doesn't really register as something particular.
Looks like clothes.
Yes,
they're wearing clothes,
especially on the Crown when there is so many of those scenes. I don't think people always realise how much has gone into it.
No, and I know obviously you can't talk about specifics because it would be a bit of a spoiler. But were there other scenes that you did in this series that were challenging, were interesting? I mean, they were all interesting, Richard. Shut up. Of course they were. But
I mean, various degrees of interesting. But I think the New York stuff was very exciting. Diana's triumphant trip to New York,
right,
which we shot in Manchester.
Okay, the Big Apple, Manchester. Yes.
Yeah, which I think I was quite surprised. It was quite an interesting take on New York, which I think worked really well. So that was great. That was to kind of arrive up there. I got the train up on Saturday morning. I think we started filming around lunchtime, and huge streets were closed off in Manchester, you know, on a Saturday lunchtime. It was really, was quite incredible. I think the locations department did a really good job.
And presumably you'd need a different set of clothes for that one, because, you know, American and English costumes, they're a crossover, but you want to make those obvious differences, don't you?
Yes. Yeah, there was a whole different hire and buy for the American stuff.
Yeah.
It was quite a different look. I think the most important thing for that was actually the faces of the extras had to look different.
Right.
I think without that, it wouldn't have really worked. When you looked at the clothes, they weren't actually that different, but it was the faces that were different, really.
Okay. Yeah, and presumably hair and makeup and things.
The hair and makeup.
Because again, we haven't really touched on this in any of the talks yet, but the relationship that you have, or the costume department has, with hair and makeup is really quite a crucial one, isn't it? It can make or break sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the important thing is to have a good dialogue with the makeup department, and just to kind of involve them as much as you can with your decisions and the reason why you're doing things, because it's tough. They have different problems to you,
right?
And I think you have to realize that, and just I think it's really important to get on with her. It doesn't work to have a division between those two departments, because we do work.
No, it's just a collaboration, absolutely, isn't it? And say I'm thinking of those 1960s films, medieval films, where they had every actress had blue eyeshadow and
and it is kind of easy to sort of to look at things and think, oh my god, well that looked terrible, but there's always things going on in the background that people don't know about when you're watching things. So
I will be interviewing Amy hopefully in a little while about her life and her work and her experiences. But what's the sort of division of labour in your mind between you and her on a production? Let's talk about The Crown, because that's an obvious one and it's the most recent. But, how does that work? She designs and redesigns and recreates the costumes. And your job is what?
Well, it's kind of everything else, just leaving her free to be as creative as possible and not to worry. I think it's about trust, really. Any designer needs to be able to trust you to get on with all the other things and make sure that everything's happening, so they don't need to think about it, so they can just get on with their creative process.
Right. So your job basically then is Amy will design the costumes and make sure that they fit the people, and presumably she'll look at the crowd people that are being dressed and say, yes, I think those look fine, thank you very much. But everything else, getting everybody there on time on set, getting all the crew there, getting the costumes there, that's all down to you, yes?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. With a big team support.
Right. And what sort of size team would you normally have on something like The Crown?
We've got about 40 people, 40 contract crew, I think.
Have you? Okay.
And obviously a lot more with dailies that come and go, that do the bigger days, and additional fitters. So I think it's probably the biggest crew that I've worked with.
Mm. And how do you go about, Giles, assembling a crew like that? You must have people that you've worked, again, a lot of this comes down to trust, doesn't it? Amy trusts you trust the person who's going to be dressing this particular principal.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to get to know your crew and to make a point, no matter whether it's the trainee or whether it's a maker. I just think you have to get to know people, to talk to people, and there's a payback for that, because there might be some trainee that you remember like years later that you think, well, that person, Amy would like that person, or it's just putting together personalities that would work well together.
Mm.
So yeah, I think when you're crewing up, it's a combination of people that the designer knows and wants to work with, and people that I know that I think that designer would like. Mm. I think it's really important that the designer feels secure with the team, and that they kind of, I think it's almost like people that can make you feel safe to be around. Yeah.
I mean, let's face it, you're spending, I mean, you do long days on filming, there's no question about that. So you're spending certainly three quarters of a day, I would think, in the company of these people, sometimes for weeks on end away from home, certainly possibly for months on end.
Yes, it has to be harmonious. I mean, obviously, there's going to be arguments and things, but on the whole, I think that is a really important part of the supervisor's job to create a team spirit and to make sure that people get on and that are happy. I mean, as you say, the hours are really long.
Yeah, and the work is, let's not kid ourselves, you're not moving bricks up and down a scaffold, but it's hard work in every sense.
No, it is. And people are really dedicated. Yeah. And sometimes you have to go the other way, and you have to make sure that people go home and that they take their 11-hour break whenever possible, because it's not good. People will work really long hours, and I think part of the supervisor's job is to keep an eye on that, because things get dangerous. And I think you don't get the best out of people if everybody is coming in for the 5 o'clock crowd call and staying till 9 o'clock at night. I don't think that's a good way of working. I think there are other ways of working which are fairer, and as I said, you get better work from people.
Yeah, give people a rest and give people breaks when you can.
Yeah.
And again, I don't suspect this. I know this. You're a man who very much leads by example. You've done these things. So presumably, you're first in and you're last out quite often on these things. Don't ask somebody to do something that you're not prepared to do yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we were saying, I really enjoy doing the big crowd days.
So tell me on a big crowd day, then what would your day sort of consist of? What time would you expect to sort of start?
Around 6.
Right.
Depending on what we do, sometimes a little bit later. I just come for the lineup and it's probably get everybody on set and then go back to Elstree where we're based for about 9 or 10, and then spend the rest of the day doing kind of more office type things. But it all varies. I mean, that's great about the Crown, that so many different types of days that you can have, and none of them are the same.
And the other aspect, of course, of your job, a huge part of your job, is actually keeping an eye on the budget and just controlling what sometimes can be a very large amount of money, but sometimes isn't, but still is it's not your money, it's not my money, so it has to be spent wisely and accounted for. And you were going to be a banker. Is this something that you see as a necessary evil, or is it something that, again, you just... I do. I have to control my budget.
Yeah, it's something, and it's something not to be scared of. I think people so often can avoid it because it can be a bit boring. But I think if there's a kind of transparency and you're discussing things from up front with costumiers, with production, then it isn't something that need be scary. Although there's big amounts of money involved, and there is a satisfaction with kind of not going over budget and managing things well when things go well.
And again, I think it's a very important part of the relationship that you and I have, is that we can discuss those things at the beginning and then we can react and further discuss those things. I mean, again, I come back to the Crown. At the beginning of the Crown, we neither of us knew there was going to be the garter ceremony. No. So how on earth could you ever budget and legislate for that at the time? So, and I think you're right that it is a case of discussion, not doing an ostrich and pretending that things aren't happening when they are, that a demand from production for another 300 costumes is going to have a financial consequence.
Absolutely,
somewhere along the way. And no nasty surprises at the end, Giles.
Yeah,
I think is all we can probably all ask for, really, in the end.
Yeah, I know, exactly. But so, it is a part of the supervisor's job, and obviously a very big part, but it's not the whole job.
No. Well, I think, again, I've heard people complain about, well, I'm not an accountant, I didn't sign up for this. Well, it kind of is part of the job, and it may not be the most enjoyable part of the job, but then getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to be on set at 6 o'clock possibly isn't the most enjoyable part of your job either sometimes. No, so.
Exactly, and it's just about planning.
Yeah.
You know how much money you've got, and as long as you're kind of look ahead and can allocate that to different areas, money can always be moved around.
Yes. Yeah. So you've mentioned us, obviously, and costume houses, and I know, again, I don't know how many costumes actually the Crown have hired this time, but it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, some of them for a shortish period of time, like the Trooping the Colour or some of the run.
Yes.
But the relationship that you said before about spending 3 years with us, but the relationship with costume houses presumably is an important one for you.
Yeah, it's very important. And I think it's so useful to actually go and meet people face to face. Every job's different. I don't know in the future when I'm going to be asking a favour from you, Richard.
I'll go on record now, Giles. Anytime you like, mate. Anytime you like.
it's true. I think if you're respectful with the people and you understand that costume houses have to make money as well, there's no point in kind of asking for these crazy deals, because you know they have to make ends meet. So I think, you know, on some jobs where there is a bigger budget, you have to understand that, and other ones when you've got a smaller budget, then hopefully people will be more generous.
Yes, and that yes,
worked well for me. But it's relationships. It's just so important to develop a relationship. I always say to people on the team, don't always email, make phone calls to people, get to know them, go out and see them. And I just think all round, you get a better result by doing that.
I think you're absolutely right. And one question, do you prefer supervising to designing? Are you, I mean, you're comfortable with both, you're good at both, but is there one, given the choice, if it was said to you, you could only ever do one of these roles for the rest of your life, which one would you opt for?
I don't know. I've never really had much of a career plan. So every job that I get offered and I do, I think, well, God, this is how on earth did I end up doing this? I still really enjoy doing both.
Right. Well, I'm not going to make you choose. You're all right. This isn't Desert Island Disc.
It would be nice to do a mixture of both.
Yeah.
But I don't know how. I don't know how seriously people take you doing both. I must say it's not, I think it's quite hard to do both, really.
Well, this is kind of what I was getting at, actually, because and Shelley, we have an interview with Shelley about the sort of apprentice scheme and training and things, and she says quite right, you know, there's one costume designer on each production, there's one costume supervisor on each production, and there are umpteen people working in the costume department. So, you know, if you're thinking of coming into the career, where do you think you ought to start first? And I suppose you're right that if you're known as doing both, then possibly you're not, and I don't say this is the case because it isn't, I think you're a fantastic costume supervisor, and I think you've wrangled, and that wrangle is the right word, I think, the crown very, very well. You know, you've kept it together, and you've headed up a great team. So, but then equally, I like Father Brown. So
yeah, it's I think it's important to remember that with supervising, depending on the designer you're working with, it's not just sums and computers. I'm lucky with Amy because sometimes I'll do the odd fitting for her and I'll get involved with crowd, and so there is a design element. I think it's very easy to just think of them as separate jobs, but how I've been lucky enough to work with designers that allow you some kind of creative input, and that's kind of satisfying for when I'm supervising. It doesn't feel like I'm not in any way responsible for the output from a design point of view at the end. So yeah, I think that's really important to know, that it's not completely two separate worlds. And I'd always say that to people that are starting out, that you don't have to kind of make a decision. Just see what happens on different jobs and what responsibilities different designers and different teams give you.
Well, I think that's an excellent piece of advice. And I think really, you know, that it comes down, as so often, doesn't it, to put your time in, learn your craft, learn your skill, get the experience, get to a position where if you say something is so, then people actually go, oh yeah, it must be then, because he said so.
Yeah, I think with crews, different people excel on different jobs. So I think it's very easy to be pigeonholed and to get kind of reputations, but I think you very much have to give people a chance and just see how they work. And kind of, for me, I kind of try to make sure I get to know everybody on the crew. And that's really useful because, you know, in a few years' time, I might remember that person and give them a job with more responsibility. I kind of like, I think it's really good to have young crews. Well, I like to work with people that I feel that they are learning something, and maybe they are kind of trying a job that they're not completely comfortable with. So they're enthusiastic and they're excited. For me, that works really well.
Well, I think that's really wise. I think that's a very healthy attitude to have, because, you know, old and experienced isn't necessarily, it may be safe, but it doesn't always give you the best results, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely. A good mixture.
Mm.
So sometimes, you know, the experience, you can't do without it.
No. Excellent. Well, Giles, I think that covers everything. That's absolutely superb. Thank you so much for...
That's okay. It's a pleasure, Richard.
And we will be seeing each other soon, very, very soon, I trust, when the costumes come back. And
Yeah.
It's been great.
Cheers, Richard.
Bye, Giles.
Bye.
That was Rich's conversation with Giles. It's amazing to see that he enjoys doing both designing and supervising and doesn't actually have a preference, is happy at the moment to go between the two.
Yes, it's also quite striking how kind of modest he is about it. You know, he still considers himself to be learning and gaining experience from other people, whereas you'd look and from the outside you think, yeah, this is a man who knows exactly what he's doing all the time.
It's interesting, when I've spoken to a designer who's a cutter, they sort of sit over the shoulder of the cutter, but they're looking at what the cutter does for them. I wonder whether Giles, when he's designing, is sitting there slowly watching the wardrobe supervisor out the corner of his eye, so they think they're, oh, I wouldn't do it that way.
Possible, I suppose. I also like the fact that he sees his job as a costume supervisor essentially just to sort of support Amy and let her get on with her designing, take all that other responsibility away, because that isn't always the case, of course.
So, Jonathan, when you work on work with Giles when he's designing, do you notice he sits on he's watching the supervisor more than most, or just gets on with what he does because he trusts them?
Well, as a designer and the type of productions that he's worked on as a designer, he's very mindful of what budget he has available, perhaps more than perhaps another designer might be in terms of being all over the budget. So a typical conversation could be if Giles can't find something in stock or he needs something for a stunt, then he will come to me with the question. But he'll also know how much he has to spend or how much he wants to spend, and he'll understand the logistics of how it's all going to work, whereas perhaps another designer might defer to their supervisor to have that conversation.
Next up in our interviews is Tim Angel, my father. I sat down with my dad and had a very good long conversation about Angels, about building the stock, and he goes into the training program and everything, and I still find things every time I speak to him I never knew before. So I found it a really interesting interview.
I thought it was a very interesting interview as well. And I was trying to figure out how long we, the three of us, have actually known him collectively. I started in 83, and I think you did as well, didn't you, Jonathan? Also,
84.
I started in 81.
So between us, we've known the man for over 100 years. So there we are.
Yes. 15 of those years, Jeremy, don't count.
Nonetheless, even if you take Jonathan and my scores and add those together, it still adds up to a hell of a lot of time. This man has been a major part of my life, Jonathan's life, and the costume world. And I think an extremely important part of that. And I think, you know, it comes out in the interview how much he cares about the business, how much he cares about the industry and the world of costume.
Absolutely. Well, here is a small sample of my conversation with Tim Angel. We will see you on the next episode.
We've changed, I've adapted the way we run the business. And, you know, with all the challenging times, we've managed to change, keep up and improve our stock. And not just buying stock for the sake of buying stock. There has to be a reason why we buy a collection. It's not just to have more and more clothes, because we don't need more and more clothes. We just need the clothes that we're lacking.